Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
And we're back. It's episode 432 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam Pineva. With me, as always, is Aiden Morgan.
Adam.
Aiden.
I'm standing like a grown man.
Yes.
You want to hear my other choice was to do this. Amaze, amaze, amaze. Are you satisfied? Did I give the people what they wanted?
Yeah. We are here to talk about the 2026's Project Hail Mary.
Oh, I think it's Project Hail Mary.
No, it isn't.
I think so. I think I'm going to call it Project Hail Mary.
Good God. Directed by Lord Miller, written by Drew Goddard, based on the Andy Weir novel, and starring, I don't know, fucking everyone, but we'll see, Ryan Gosling.
Yeah,
Sandra Hüller, James Ortiz, Lionel Boyce.
Meryl Streep.
Yeah, for a second, yes.
a line of Meryl Streep.
Yeah, so this, you know, Amazon put this thing out. They paid $3 million for this. Partially because The Martian was a huge hit. And
yeah,
we're going to kind of have to talk about that as well. Not talk about the movie so much as some of the adaptation issues. Because that was the first weird novel to be adapted. This is the second.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing overperformed like no one expected.
Yeah, very popular.
To the point where Weir's middle book, which no one really cared for, is now going to be adapted by Lord Miller. And he's also supposed to write like an original screenplay for them.
Yeah, I worry about that. Just because sometimes novel, like there's something about, I mean, I haven't read Project Hail Mary, I've read The Martian. And I really enjoy his novels.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure. I can't really feel him doing like a character-based screenplay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Seems like an odd fit, but you never know.
So the basic plot rundown here is, you know, there's something that is slowly eating the sun.
No.
A science teacher wakes up in a spaceship with no memory and slowly regains his memory as he also figures out that he is in the far reaches of space to try to save Earth and meets an alien friend along the way. So I'm going to say, like most people, you were like, I love this movie.
Yes, I do. I mean, okay, I have caveats, and I love the way it's directed scene by scene.
Uh-huh.
But I think there are issues with the film overall, and I don't know what changes have been made in the adaptation, which is one of the things I want to talk to you about. But I do overall, like, I had to shut down parts of my brain to really enjoy this film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it. That's my overall take.
And here's the thing. Both The Martian and Project Hail Mary, as novels, have a whole lot more science to them.
Of course.
They also obviously have whole chunks that were taken out for the films.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever read, I don't know if you read The Martian.
Yeah, I've read The Martian.
Okay. Yeah, like the whole like sandstorm thing is just gone, right? Because you don't really need it.
Yeah.
And that's fine, right? Like The Martian as a film reduces the science, the raw science down to just what you need and keeps moving. The problem with Project Hail Mary for me and why like I like the film, it didn't hit me anywhere. Like when I watched The Martian, I'd read the book first. I was like, I like the book, but I think I enjoy the movie overall, right? The movie kind of brought some of the vision and just some of the tone to life in a way that the book hadn't managed to.
Mm-hmm.
With Project Hail Mary, I think the reverse happened.
Interesting.
The tone is different. There are a lot of changes, some of which are very necessary, but I do argue that a lot of them either harm the story in a weird way, and specifically through character. I don't know what else you could have done, but they do. Or they just, they make it so that you don't understand why something is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they just kind of happen.
Yeah, okay.
And that kept annoying me in the movie, was this stuff just happened. And if you know the book, you're like, oh, well, this happened because of this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Can you give me an example?
Let's think of a good example here. And then now, of course, I'm like completely lost, right? And think of an exact example of the, like, just stuff just happened. There was just a lot of like, oh, and now we need, you know, the Talmeba. Okay, well, it doesn't react to nitrogen. And look, while you were asleep, like, here it is now. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay, right? Like, but it just happens off camera. It's just, we just need to get through this plot point and mention that we bred it so that later we can have it, so that this is why it could go through the Xenite, because they were breeding it in that, so along with adapting it to nitrogen, they accidentally did this.
Yeah, there's stuff like that.
Right, in the book, it's a fairly long process that it's like ongoing while other things are happening. And you just get a better sense for it. This was a whole, this wasn't easy.
Yeah, I think one of the things I this movie was missing that The Martian had was that sense of procedure.
Right.
Like they, because Lord and Miller often seem to default to like a montage set to needle drops.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, fun to watch and effective, but you can tell that they're doing it to be more like that. They're thinking, what can we do to please the crowd? Right. This is a movie that really plays for the cheap seats.
Yeah, no, and that's fair. It's just like, again, like I think the initial bits of the movie were where it annoyed me the most, because Eva Stratt in the book is a different character.
I have heard this. Yes,
she is not some like administrator type who is, you know, working for. No, she has single and sole authority over every government on Earth.
Right, she's like a monster with a cause.
Yes, she admits it. And she is a great character to watch work, because it is just kind of, it is shocking sometimes just to, you know, watch them wield this much power and willingly abuse it, going, when this is all over, they're going to arrest me. Because of all the crimes I'm committing, basically. It gets like humanity itself at this point. But this is what it's going to take. And so it's just interesting watching this woman work, who knows that she is damning herself and is willing to do it. Mm. Right? It puts her as a counterpoint to Grace. From the minute, well, not that you know about the whole Grace thing, which, but it puts her as a counterpoint to him later. But also in the whole beginning bit where he is, you know, like he's doing all the experiments and all this, there weren't other people there. It was just her at first.
Okay.
And then she just leaves. The whole, like, we have Carl there helping him out type of thing. No. It's like, you don't want all of this time of him talking out loud to himself. You want someone to bounce off of. You know what I mean?
Right. Yep.
But in doing that, they reduce the amount of actual hard work he had to do to get to where he is. And I would argue, important things about the organisms that make them make sense. I don't know that you need, but like as a reader, like unlike some of the Martian stuff, these I think really helped me like flesh it out, right? Like the whole, he poked it with a needle and it died. Why? How is it like reflecting all light? It's like there's a heat issue there, and it's like this explains why they migrate and how, and like it's all removed. Instead, you have like Grace and his buddy who suggests the winning strategy. A lot of what they do minimizes Grace's abilities.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's. I mean, like you can kind of see why. Like it's in keeping with the bumbling.
Yeah.
Persona that Gosling
it makes
employs.
Him more likable.
Makes him very likable, yes. Not
in a quick shorthand. And yeah, again, because you don't want him just narrating to the audience.
That's exactly it. Yeah, like you can
so
see,
I get it.
Like you can see the choices. Like the,
right.
I think that's
right.
Yeah, like I say, I think that's one of the things I do like about this. Even though I don't agree with some, or actually a number of choices in this film, I like being able to like feel. That they made choices and just to compare and contrast very briefly with Craig Gillespie's Supergirl, one of the things I didn't enjoy about Supergirl, which I enjoyed overall, was
Supergirl
that...
Supergirl as well as this, if you haven't seen Supergirl, because there are going to be a lot of people who haven't necessarily seen Supergirl who are listening.
Right.
To
this. Yes. But there, so there are, give us there a, few are a lot of... Yeah. yeah, no, I'm not going to go on. Just that quite often I felt like there were no choices at some points in the Supergirl movie, or rather sure. that the studio was making choices rather than it like the director, which apparently is the case.
Sure. So, but I mean, yeah. but yeah, no, in this you can definitely feel the hand of the directors and the adaptation, right?
Yes.
And it's not always a bad thing, don't get me wrong. But like with Rocky,
mm-hmm.
you know, Rocky in the book basically seals off, and there's a big thing about Rocky that they just left out. Rocky basically seals off like half of the ship. He's not running around in a bubble where he can't get anything to breathe.
Right.
That made no sense, but it plays better for the cameras.
Yeah, yeah. I was watching it. Like, the first time I watched it, I didn't think about it too much. When I was watching it, actually, this morning, I was like, man, how much atmosphere does Rocky need? Because he seems to spend a lot of time in his right. little sort of Rocky ball.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, obviously, we're just not supposed to.
Right. And I do like that they use the practical effect. Like the puppet Rocky was great, but there's one mention of the like, is that ammonia? And the whole thing is that Rocky, like what's the alien name? I can never think of it. Iridian atmosphere is a lot hotter.
Yes.
And B, ammonia heavy. And this right. is important because, like, when they're passing stuff back and forth at first, it's incredibly hot. It isn't when it's tossed through space because the heat bleeds off. Well, like, that actually does play into things in the plot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Rocky gets hurt and actually Rylan does drag him into, like, his component section and, like, badly burns himself doing it. There's also a bit I kind of enjoy because that's completely missing from the movie, and it's not necessary. It is one of those things like that Martian storm. It's not necessary. But I did like it personally.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, like, he sees all the soot and all this, and he sees Rocky is, like, you know, hurt and not responsive. And so he goes in with, like, this canister of air, basically, remotely. And, like, blows all the dust free, and then Rocky's like, no, that almost killed me. That like, smoke and dust is what we caught ourselves with internally to heal.
Oh.
And it's not, like, played for laughter, I think, but it's just one of these, like, it's such a great, like, obvious, like, you're looking from an Earth center, you're like, oh, of course that's what it would be. But it makes no sense, so of course he tried this thing, right?
Right.
So there's a lot of that, where it's just, like, mm-hmm. there's stuff taken out that... I don't know, helps the point of view that makes Rylan more active in his own story. That makes him way more competent.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a whole, which I thought was interesting too, is the whole, like, the Petroviscope does not work while the centrifuge is in motion in the ship.
Oh.
There's a reason, I forget what it is now, in the book that made sense. It was one of those things of just, like, it needed to, like, not have the stress on it. So they kept having to flip back and forth, and when are they doing which? And it's like, it becomes a whole thing.
Oh.
You know, it's like the Beatles, which is why the recovery drones were called the Beatles.
Right.
Because they could go way faster, which is why they were named John, Paul, Ringo. See? That you just get at the very end for no reason.
Okay.
Those Beatles are the entire point of the mission. And they weren't really mentioned. Past, like, well, then we send it back to Earth, and then at the very end.
Right.
It's so weird to me because, like, cannibalizing, like, one of them was kind of a thing. Like, it's there's a whole lot of complexity in the novel which is stripped out for good reason, mm-hmm. and there's a whole lot of stripped out for terrible result, frankly.
Huh.
That just kind of annoyed me because, again, I felt like it was just being dumbed down a little bit, and it dumbed Rylan down.
Ah.
They also took out. Things that one that might have just I might have missed in one sentence of mention, but there is a mention of a coma gene that, like, there is a gene that they established that lets people survive long-term comas.
Right, I heard about this in the novel. Yeah,
right, and that's why it had to be for Rylan because he was right. the only other person there.
Yeah.
But also that the drug they give him specifically gives you short-term memory loss.
Oh.
Because Eva's whole plan was if he wakes up and everyone else is there, it's fine. But if by chance what happens happens, that he won't like wake up and start freaking out about like I don't want to be here and all that and like screw something up.
Right.
So it just, again, the book is well thought out in a way that the movie is kind of slapdash with a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that just, I don't know, it just annoyed me a little bit.
Yeah, no, I completely get that. And I'm kind of glad that I didn't read the book first, because you can feel the movie, like you say, being slapdash about a lot of that,
right,
the sort of the scientific things. And I'm glad I didn't know the details, so I didn't have to worry about
even it. Even the Iridian ship annoyed me. Like, weirdly, part of the whole thing in the book is that it's made with like right angles, which you don't do with spacecraft, because for keeping pressurization, the stressors are way harder on right angles.
Uh-huh.
But the Venite is so strong, it doesn't matter.
Oh.
Right. And even the whole, like, oh, his people died because of radiation. Did you notice that slip by?
Right, yeah. Yes. Yeah,
and it's tied into they don't see, so they don't see color. And, like, their whole planet is basically dark. And there's a whole thing of, like, he basically shims in why they happen to look up and see the stars type of thing.
Huh.
But they didn't know about radiation because they couldn't see the frequency. They never figured out that end of things. So just their entire different branch of science becomes a point,
yeah,
and it has to be back figured, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, I know that they kind of just go over that real, real quick, like just in like part of the in voiceover and montage.
Yeah.
It's funny because this reminds me. So I was at one point I was watching, especially during that sequence, I thought this is like a cuddly version of Arrival, which in itself was a stripped down and in some cases kind of dumbed down version of Chang's story of your life. And here's where I really stumbled, or the part of the movie that bounced off on me.
Yeah.
The fact that they were able to find common language and vocabulary just kind of drove me nuts, because I'm like, no, well, anyway.
No, I like the book better in that we find out that Grace has a music background, and that he builds this whole thing with like specific chords and tones.
Okay.
Out of the fact that they make musical tones to speak. And then he doesn't like make a fake translator to translate Rocky. He just picks up the language because he's so used to looking at and hearing it and going through it that he starts to pick it up quickly.
Interesting.
Because he's not really going to deal with that part of his brain.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a much better hack. But again, to the movie, you don't want just two people chirping. It just, that doesn't work.
No. That would be, I mean, I would watch that movie, but I can understand why lots of people would not.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's big. Yeah, it felt like just, it was like big blockbuster filmmaking.
Right.
With a really sort of like, with a real bleeding heart at the center of it.
No, and the original book was great.
Yeah.
And I will say that having read the book, with obviously no idea what was happening in the story, here's a question. In the movie, how did it hit you when you found out that he was a coward?
Like when he says, no, I can't do it. That didn't strike me as cowardice so much as like, yeah, that makes sense. I too would say no. Although I'm just trying to think about this. It didn't strike me as like a terrible false note or anything. No. I probably would have enjoyed it more if there had been more of a reason for him to stay. I mean, but I think the problem is it would have made Sandra Hüller's character, Eva Stratt, look really monstrous.
Well, let me tell you, and again, this is part of the problem. The way the flashbacks are dealt out in the book, I actually remember when I was reading this book, I actually at one point just like cursed out loud because he was timing the flashbacks So they felt organic, but they always either revealed something you were about to find out or illuminated something you just learned.
Okay, that was my question, was about the structure of the book for the flashback.
So well done, it hurts me. Like, seriously, read the book, if nothing else, for the structure of that. It was impeccable. And I do call it cowardice, just because it's the, you know, like, okay, everyone else in this is just like, well, we can save all of Earth by doing this one thing. And mm-hmm. yes, it will cost you your life, but if you don't do it, you're going to die anyway.
Yeah, but I was surprised.
In the book, specifically, it's cowardice, because it's even pointed out. He left his position as a major scientist to go teach, like, elementary school, rather than defend himself.
Okay.
He has no friends, he has no one, because he is a giant coward. Like, he won't commit to anything. He always keeps himself separate. And you keep seeing it in the flashbacks, and eventually he gets called on it. Like, this is your problem.
Oh, that doesn't really come across in the movie the same way.
It doesn't. It's said when he was like, you don't have any friends or family. You don't even have a dog.
Yeah. Yeah, he says at one point, I put up walls in my relationship.
Yeah.
And he talks about, you know, being unable to make a relationship work.
But that's it. It's like he has, like, completely isolated himself outside of, like, you know, the schoolwork. But if you get a sense that, no, he is a big coward.
Huh.
And that, in a weird way, having his memories removed let him actually be free of his own past enough to become the person that he wanted to be.
Well, see, that would be, you know what? That would be a better movie.
And it's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
Because around the time he kind of learns that, oh God, I was this coward, I did this whole thing, is when he learns the one other thing that is not explicitly said in the movie. He's running out of food.
Ah.
Because things take way longer than they seem in the movie.
I feel like you could eat the chalmeba, though. I don't know.
Yeah.
This is, but.
But he's running out of food. He has enough food to either save Rocky or get home, but not both.
Huh. Oh, okay. I see. Huh.
And he decides to give up on ever going home, which was the thing he refused to do, to go save Rocky because he has an actual true friend for the first time.
Hmm.
And it makes sense, given, like, there's the character growth, right?
Right.
He cares more about this person and this thing than he did anything else, so.
Yeah.
It works out really well.
Yeah, I think you're locating for me what feels like, I'll put it this way. Like, I understand that they're going to, like, make choices in the movie that sort of remove some of the science, dumb it down, and strip nuance away. And I'm like, yeah, I get that. But what you're describing feels like an actual failure. Like, Lord Miller.
It's still a good, fun movie. The problem is they kind of stripped the beating heart out of it halfway.
Yeah, that's exactly.
And it's there for me because I know the book, so I can watch the movie and fill in the pieces.
Yeah, okay. That's, you made the movie worse for me. Thanks a lot, Adam.
No, it is, like I said, it's fascinating because, again, the movie does work.
Yes.
But there is a beating heart to it that is kind of absent.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is this whole thing of, like, this is what he's willing to give up. At the end of the day, he finds something worth sacrificing for. And it's, you know, this other dude who was in the same boat. Also, a funny little note there that, again, it doesn't matter. But it was one of those, my head was like, wait, why? The whole, like, oh yeah, Rocky's ship has way too much, like, fuel that he can lend some to Ryland. Is remembering in his race, not big on this stuff. They had no concept of relativity.
Right.
So they didn't realize. So they way overfueled. Yeah. Which is, again, just funny. Also, the very end is different in one respect. He ends up on the Iridian planet. He is in a much smaller dome. It's kind of more in, like, the center of town sort of thing. And it's often dark outside of the lights in his own dome because they don't need the lights.
Right.
But Rocky tells him that they have been observing Earth's sun and have seen it be restored to the proper level of, you know, intensity. We never go back to Earth. Ever. In the story. The book stays with Ryland.
Huh. So there's no sort of scene of the Talmud, like them getting the samples and.
No. You. The only proof you have is that the son is restored, and that the Iridians were keeping an eye on it for him, and he's obviously much older by then.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. Like the longer passage of time makes a lot of.
Right. So Ryland leaves them, and I wonder because they've mentioned they want to work on a sequel to this. And I wonder if it's tied up in one of the things that is not explicitly mentioned in the movie, but is in the book, weirdly enough, is that among the things he sends back is exactly which sun the Iridians are on. Around. Hmm. So that they can come and find him if they ever want to.
Interesting.
Yeah. And like when they first kind of mentioned it, I was like, oh, so the Earth is a show up again? No. Okay, we just stay with Roland. Like, and he has this great little life where he gets to teach these kids and he has his best friend.
Yes. Well, interesting. But yeah, the ending was that was quite sweet. A little too sweet for my taste, to be honest.
I mean, it's fine. I do like that that Weird has decided to take on one fan comment apparently as actual like committed thing in the universe. Not that it matters, but it just amuses me.
Mm-hmm.
That the little habitat that Ryland is in, he has named Graceland, and he refuses to explain to Rocky why it's funny.
That's amusing.
Yeah. Apparently some fan mentioned the Weird. He's just like, yep, that's it. Like, that is now canon. And I just like that. Yeah, so like I said, like I personally like I enjoy the film. I think it works as a good shorthand. Like way more than The Martian, which is a really, like, maybe it's a Ridley Scott versus the Lloyd Miller thing, but, like, The Martian is a really considered whole product.
Right.
That is, again, I like better than the book because I do feel that as much as I do love The Martian, the book, I feel like it can get a little too bogged down in the science sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I have a high threshold for that. But on occasion. And, you know, again, I would say if there's one thing I could return to The Martian, it would be that sandstorm. I would have loved to just... And again, I don't think it works in the movie as written, because if you watch and read The Martian, you'll see that, like, in the book, he has way less contact with NASA than he does in the movie, because he needs it in the movie. Because, again, he can't just be talking to himself the whole time.
True. That is quite true.
So the whole, like, is he going to steer clear of this, and watching him kind of go into the sandstorm and then figure it out and get out, is a wonderfully tense bit of back and forth writing that you couldn't do in the movie the way the movie is. So fair.
Hmm.
But Project Hail Mary, I mean, again, it's not that it's a fucking, it's already a long movie, and I think this is the problem, is that I want like the other half hour that would have explained just a few things.
Yeah, I get that.
And again, just let Ryland be as smart as he is.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I would. Yeah, there's a darker and denser movie that could have been made, and I don't. And like I say, I do not blame Lord and Miller and Amazon MGM for doing what they did. But you know, so and I want more than what could have been. But it is interesting to contemplate.
Yeah, and again, I mean, it's even darker. It's just things like letting Ryland be. Like the weird genius that he can be makes things like, oh god, are they throwing a bomb at me, and watching the thing bounce off and just go off to space, and then why is it going so slow? Oh, they think I'm dumb. And that's fair. Like it makes all of those scenes hit better because there's way more gulf of contrast.
Yes.
That's all. And it's missing in the film.
That is interesting.
So again, I really do enjoy the film. I will probably watch the film more than once, happily. However, unlike The Martian, it will not, I think, for me, become like a comfort watch that I happily watch like a bunch.
Right. I'm glad you finally got to see it, though.
Oh yeah, the journey to seeing it pissed me off in so many ways. Can I just tell you?
Yes.
Well, no, just to talk on this for a minute, because Amazon are fuckers.
True.
they dropped the pre-order for, well, they put it on, you know, pay, like, video on demand to pay for it at the full price thing of, like, their $30 to rent it or buy it, $20, $25, whatever it was. And then they were like, here's the pre-orders for the Blu-ray and the 4K. They're separate. They don't have digital codes. Okay. A lot of movies, a lot of things are doing this now, although they usually have digital codes. And they'll do a Steelbook limited edition thing that has both the 4K and the Blu-ray and a digital code. Cool. They don't announce it. They don't announce it. They don't announce it. They finally announced the 4K Blu-ray limited edition thing. No digital code at all. Also, it releases 2 months later than the other versions. What? So that's frustrating. So I go, well, fuck this then, because they've also moved it to like MGM Plus, which they own. So you have to pay a fee as well to see it regardless. So I go, fuck it, I'm just buying a digital copy. I'll just buy it on iTunes instead, whatever. Because I'm sick of waiting to watch it. But the only reason I hadn't done this, right?
Right, yeah.
Because I'm like, the price, it's fine, it's all good. So I buy it, and then you and me decide we're going to watch it. And then it turns out that this weekend, it goes up on Prime for free in the U.S.
I just saw that.
Like, you goddamn motherfuckers. That last one. I don't think I just... for me, but
that is so funny. I went on to Prime and I'm like, I guess it's on VOD. Oh no, it's free. All right.
Yeah.
Great timing for me.
Right. She's like, okay, fine. Yeah, it's again, like, I'm not gonna be upset. Like, I, you know, make my choices. I could have been more patient and seed and wait till last minute, etc. But it was just kind of funny.
But I'll tell you, this really makes me want to read the novel now.
I think the book is fantastic.
You know what they should have done for the adaptation? It should have just been Andy Weir sitting there reading the novel to the camera.
Did I ever tell you?
I do not know yet.
Okay, so R. Kelly, piece of shit. R. Kelly did a series of videos. 33 chapters.
Is that the Trapped in the Closet thing?
Yes.
Yes.
If you got it on DVD, which, by the way, they originally released on DVD.
Wow.
And at one point, you could rent that on Netflix. It came with commentary by R. Kelly.
Oh, now, okay.
Most DVD commentary, as I'm sure everyone is aware, is an audio track.
Right.
Not this.
Oh my god.
This was a static camera setup facing a movie screen in a small theater watching all 33 pieces while R. Kelly sat on an aisle seat in one of the like few rows that you could see talking about it and occasionally pausing the thing to turn around and talk directly to the camera. And when he would, do things like, so you see in the scene what I was thinking was that I was trapped in the closet, but I needed to escape. And you were, but not there. We're okay.
You know, I've seen some of Trapped in the Closet, and my only conclusion, this was a time before I knew that R. Kelly was like an enormous shit. I just thought, this man is an absolute fucking lunatic.
I have not only seen all 33 parts of Trapped in the Closet more than once. Wow. I have, again, sat through the entire commentary.
That's amazing.
Well, because when you rent that DVD and you start, and like you do this, and you're like, holy shit. And then you tell a friend, and the friend has to come over and see it, and then like it spirals. It just fucking spirals.
Sounds like.
Anyway, I don't know that we have anything else to really talk about with the Project Hail Mary. So, again, good movie. Not saying it's not a good movie. I think I only thought a little bit less of it than a lot of people do because I have the contrast of what it could be.
Of course. And I was one of the things when we were talking about doing Project Hail Mary, I pitched the idea of like me coming to it blind, you coming to it knowing the book. And you thought that it would not make a huge difference. Or you said something like, well, maybe.
I think it would make the same difference as The Martian, right? Like it might be even better, but and it would reduce the amount of science.
But there is more to the differences than you anticipated. So there you go. And found it, you know, the opposite of The Martian in that sense.
Yeah, which is sad. I'm gonna say, like, I like Lord Miller in general,
mm-hmm.
but for something like this, I really do think that, like, someone like, you know, Ridley Scott's gonna do better on Andy Weir books.
Fair enough. Yeah,
it's a specific weird type of thing,
right? Yeah, maybe. Yeah, and Lord and Miller are too, maybe a little too sentimental in some ways, a little too sort of, like a little too cartoonish. I mean, that's.
They want to have their style, whereas Ridley Scott is confident enough to step back and let the story do what it needs to do,
mm-hmm.
and override his own sense of style for the story. Yeah. When doing something like this. That's all.
Yeah. I was actually thinking about Ridley Scott earlier today. For some reason, when watching Project Hail Mary, I was thinking about Scott's Alien Covenant, a movie that I saw in theaters and really hated when I saw it. But it's kind of grown in my estimation because it was one of those films where once I had had some time to think about it, I actually kind of appreciated the fact that he was clearly asked by the studio to make an Alien sequel. And he's like, yeah, okay, how about I make a Gothic House of Horrors film that's actually a Prometheus sequel, and then in the last half hour, I'll speed run you through an Alien movie. How do you like that, assholes?
Right.
And as a kind of a middle finger to whatever it is the studio wanted, I do enjoy it on that front very much.
So we're like about 40 minutes in. Do we want to spend a few minutes, and again, you know, just because we have both seen Supergirl, and I don't know that I want to spend an entire episode talking about it. So if you haven't seen Supergirl, if you don't want it spoiled, this is where we're going to tell you right now, instead of at the end of the episode, we'll say it again, but that you should come back next week for Battle Beyond the next episode, whatever that is, for Battle Beyond the Stars from 1980. Mm-hmm. But for right now, we're going to talk about Supergirl.
Which, just as I threatened to call Project Hail Mary Project Hail Mary, I will threaten to call this Supergirl.
Okay.
But it's a hollow threat. I will actually call it Supergirl because that would be very annoying.
So, initially, I think we are, not really, but we're kind of in a reverse situation here where I never fully read the original.
Oh, okay. I have, but I mean, honestly, I read it in the sort of the alcoholic fugue state of the pandemic. So I didn't remember much of it. So I read about half.
Well, apparently, neither did the screenwriter, if you didn't know this bit. No, seriously.
Really?
You know, misunderstood the ending? Have you not heard this?
I've heard a little bit about it, but I don't know. I don't remember the ending of King's Woman of Tomorrow.
So we're going to spoil the end of the film here and the comic.
Please do. Please do.
In the comic, they toss Krem in the Phantom Zone. And then, what's her name?
Ruthie?
Thank you. I'm like, Gracie. No, it's the wrong movie. Ruthie basically tells people that she killed him. And then when she's like older and all this, he's let out of the Phantom Zone and like apologizes and the whole thing.
Huh.
And you find out that like he didn't actually kill him.
Well, I can understand why they didn't do that, but
apparently the screenwriter misread or didn't finish reading or something the original, and like, you know, they've kind of talked about it with this whole like, oh well, I thought because, and they say because Ruthie kills him, this is not what happens. That she shouldn't do that, so instead Kara should do it. The entire reason we have this weird, which I have an issue with, that she kills him at the end is because the screenwriter misread the fucking comic.
That feels kind of embarrassing.
Yeah. Also, I am willing to accept all sorts of weirdness in Superman mythos that don't exist in the comics, God knows. That's fine. Invent shit. But Green Suns act like kryptonite makes no fucking sense.
No, that feels like Green Lanterns being, you know, freaked out by the color yellow.
The color yellow, it doesn't make any sense, but at least it's consistent. The idea that, like, Green Suns act like kryptonite would mean that Red Suns act like red kryptonite, but that's not what happens.
Nope.
So shut the fuck up. Like, and that might be in the comic. I honestly don't know.
It is in the comic.
Thank you, Tom King. Why would you do that? Why?
Yeah, they banish. Krem banishes Supergirl to that planet, and she has to. And it actually makes even less sense because in the movie it's a green and a yellow sun binary system. In that one, she just has to wait until the sun goes down, and then she gets her powers back. And that's
what.
Then she flies out. Like, Ruthie has to defend her from monsters all day for like 9-10 hours. And then while Supergirl goes through the tortures of being green sunned. And then sunsets. She's like, okay, back at it.
Weird. Okay.
It's an effective sequence, but it's like, that doesn't make, why would a green sun do that? Is it kryptonite? What are you talking about? I mean, it was made as a prison for Kal-El. It's like, yeah, it's a kryptonite sun. Sure, why not?
Sure. And past that, like, I really did like the movie.
I actually enjoyed the movie too.
You know, I don't. It was interesting because I've had this discussion a few times in different ways over the last couple weeks before Supergirl even. Was it the whole, like, growing up, like, superheroes didn't kill anyone, and that was just, like, the thing. Mm-hmm. And then, like, in the movies, like, they all do? Like, you know, like, Captain America and Iron Man will fucking kill people every, like, 10 seconds. And it doesn't tend to bother me. But it bothers me specifically with three characters, and always will. Right, Batman, Superman, Spider-Man are held to a slightly different standard.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it feels right. And I feel like if you're going to wear the S or work for Batman, you are factored into that.
Fair enough.
So I feel like if they were going to deal with the whole, like, oh, she killed this guy, going forward, I would, like, if they do it interestingly, that could be good. But realistically, you know, they're not. They're just going to ignore it. And so it's just like this weird outlier of problem.
Yeah, I guess my problem with that ending is it just, like, you know, you kind of have to remove Krem. Like, he's not going to stop otherwise. But also, it didn't quite feel earned. It didn't hit the way they clearly wanted it to.
Right.
And I was like, well, you know, if you, I don't, well, you know, it's like Man of Steel where he, you know, he kills Zod, snaps Zod's neck. I mean, I didn't like that, but it did make sense. It's like, how else are we going to deal with Zod? I guess maybe put him back in the Phantom Zone. I don't know. But, you know, it was something. But this was like...
It is, in fact, Phantom Zone, so...
Yeah. I don't know. And I wasn't even... I guess I wasn't even mad like I was with Man of Steel. I was just like, oh, okay, yeah, that happened.
Well, she's a different character, and it's set up differently, right? Like...
Yeah. But I was saying, one thing I really... I bet there are parts of the movie... Like you're saying, that I genuinely enjoyed. I like Millie Alcock's version of Supergirl.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I thought she was great. I mean, she's not Melissa Benoist. That's a very different, you know, take on the character.
Right, she shouldn't be.
And so I sort of appreciated a different kind of Supergirl.
Yeah.
I like her dynamic with Ruthie. And there's a lot of that early stuff with a lot of the aliens and them having to take like a space bus. Like, that stuff was just, I don't know. I thought that was incredibly fun. And yeah. I just really loved sort of seeing her just kind of like have to be more or less kind of an ordinary citizen in some ways for a lot of the movie and only intermittently be able to like really use her powers. And then you only really see her use her powers at the end. I actually really enjoyed that final sort of dusty ass action sequence set to the acoustic version of the middle. I knew what the needle drop would be. I'd sort of gathered it, what it was going to be. And I was like, but when I realized it was not the song, but a cover of the song, I'm like, thank God. And then you just get like her protecting Ruthie. That's
right.
And you get that real sense at that point. You get a real sense of like the Tom King comic, Bill Kieverly, like this sense of like this young woman seeing this other person as essentially just an unknowable, like invulnerable God figure.
Yeah.
That moment there was like probably as close to some of the comics sort of like real juice that the movie gets. So that bit I loved.
Yeah, no, there's a lot to really enjoy in it. I thought again the fight in the space bus was really well staged.
I love that. Yeah, that was good.
Slowly seeing the yellow sun and then coming back. Like that entire bit was just the entire scene was just really well done. Yeah. The bar fight, like the logo bit, the Lobo bits were vaguely unnecessary.
Yeah, I mean I could have done without Lobo. Yeah, right. Exactly. It was sort of I felt like you could have had a cut of this movie without Lobo, and it would have made almost no difference to the story.
And I kind of like that they kind of admit that in a weird way. Without ever saying it. It's like you could feel it, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
At no point are you like, oh, well, they better get Lobo in here. No.
Yeah. I mean, obviously they're throwing, I mean, they do this in a lot of sort of, I guess, B-tier superhero movies. They throw in another character to like, that they can spin off later or just to bolster the appeal. You know, it really did feel like at some point they're like, yeah, let's put Lobo in here. And really get the, you know, get those like, you know, fanboys who might not be into like Supergirl. Get a bit of Lobo.
Right. Like get them in there with some Lobo. Why not? It doesn't hurt anything.
I don't know if you know this, but apparently Tom King's earliest pitch for The Woman of Tomorrow was actually not Ruthie and Supergirl, but Supergirl and Lobo.
You say that, but there is a delightful comic. Hold on, let me.
Okay, now I'm. You. I'm intrigued.
So there's a Brave and the Bold run that was like 12 issues, I want to say.
Oh.
You can get it in like two trades. I think it's the, what is it? The Lords of Luck and the Book of Destiny is volumes 1 and 2.
Okay.
And they're by Wade and Perez. So first of all.
Oh, okay.
First of all. And the conceit of it is that across the issues, it changes, it's Brave and the Bold, but it changes who teams up with who. So that like in the first issue, and I don't remember how this works exactly, so forgive me. But in like, you know, one issue, it'd be like Batman and Wonder Woman. And then the next issue, it'll be Wonder Woman and Supergirl. So there's always a character handing it off.
Oh, neat.
But it also kind of tells one big story.
Huh.
While also telling like two cool separate stories. And one of the issues is, in fact, Supergirl and Lobo.
Huh. Not funny.
Especially if you want to, like, ever read, like, I will say that that is one of the best, like, 12-issue runs because it is just Wade and Perez just taking a tour through the DC universe.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It is one of my favorite things. And again, a lot of it is just the, you know, the handoffs, right? Like, I'm trying to remember how that all worked. Oh yeah, I think it's like they don't always hand off right because it's like 3 is Batman and Blue Beetle, and then 4 is Supergirl and Lobo. But again, it's a tour through the DC universe at the time. It's a whole lot of fun.
Yeah.
So,
cool. I really recommend it. Cool. I will pick that up. I was also gonna say. One of the things I've been really kind of a little baffled by with the response to this movie is I'm not surprised that those are some of the bad faith responses. Those are just going to be what they're going to be. But a lot of film critics are just really, really down on Supergirl. And the only thing I can think is that maybe they're just sick of superhero films. That's also understandable. But I wonder if they felt after kind of the way that Gunn's Superman feels like it felt like a breath of fresh air, and this feels like they were expecting a film that was A, more like that, and B, just something different from Gunn and Safran's DC universe. And to see a film with a lot of, you know, a lot of like brown CG alien stuff, and something that feels more like a traditional gritty superhero film. That,
well, I mean, I think the fact that it's very much like Mad Max Western coded, then superhero coded threw people off. I think the idea that it really was a story about trauma.
Yeah.
And how it warps you was not what anyone expected. And again, for to be completely unfair about it, you know how that works, right? Like the Superman stuff, like Gunn was kind of on top of things. And they were like, look, he can fix stuff. So it's like, of course, now they have to tear it down.
Right. Yeah.
Right? Like,
there's an
regardless
element
of like the Chud reactions, because fuck them. my favorite of those, by the way, has been, well, we all know that historically Supergirl doesn't do well in the theaters. I'm like, because of one movie that was famously like poisoned from the get-go? We know this? Really? Yeah. Okay, cool. Neat. But anyway, like I said, like, they're not even worth like fucking thinking about. But I do think that a lot of the other, like, the critics are just like, oh, it's a, you know, like, whatever, was the, oh, we see a window to pounce. And conflict, you know, saying this movie is fine, but not, like, the best thing on earth, doesn't fucking get clicks.
Yeah, that's quite true.
Saying it's, like, an amazing launch to a new universe gets clicks.
Yep.
Saying it's a fine, solid fucking film, but it does not change the universe, doesn't get you clicks, but going, it's flop, gets clicks.
Yes.
And I think they just leaned into that bullshit.
No, I completely agree. And I think there are definite flaws with the film.
Of course.
You know, I mean, so some of the action sequences I enjoy, but some of them were pretty damn incoherent.
Sure.
I mean, Krem isn't like the disaster.
Hey, no. I'm going to say, but I really like Krem, and I can tell you why.
Tell me.
That's something that no one else I've seen mentioned. You know what I love about when a character does? Like, honest to God, this might be a me thing.
When they're Belgian in space? What?
Yes. No, when you give me a character that constantly is engaging in a sense, where they're just rooted in a sense, and one of the easiest ones to show on film is they're always eating.
Yeah, he is.
They're tasting,
yeah.
They're always experiencing. It's a very sensual thing. Not like in a sexy way, but just a sense-forward type of thing for a character. Like Rusty in the Ocean's 11, right? He's eating every shot. Rusty has to have like half a burger, and he's throwing half of it out because he just wants that constant experience of food.
Mm-hmm.
And giving that to Krem was such a wonderful thing of just like, here's an absolute piece of shit, right? Like, he's a total dickbag. Don't get me wrong.
But he likes pie.
But he always wants to be like, he's always going to eat something that he sees if it's there.
Yep.
He's going to find a way to just be like, because he wants the experience. He wants that constant sensory information.
Yeah, I found it notable that like in the big action set piece later on, he ends up with that drinking that milk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a great character note to me. I love it when people do it.
Yeah, no, that's. I thought that was good. I felt like. I don't know. It just. I didn't think it was that bad. Like Krem, like Matthias Schoenaerts' portrayal.
Yeah.
I suppose. I mean, it could have been better, I guess. But I'm like,
I think people want, like, people are used to that whole formula of like, it's the worst thing ever. Like, this wasn't. I mean, it wasn't that it was like low stakes. It was like human trafficking. But in terms of like he wasn't trying to like destroy the universe, man.
Right.
He was just like a scumbag making money and, you know, being a like a terrible human trafficker. Like that's all he was. And so it's not big enough.
But yeah.
If they went big, they would have said that it was why do we always have to go big?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's why they sort of, you can see them trying to like build him up by, you know, saying he's the strength of 1,000 men. You know, to make him sort of an adversary, worthy adversary to Supergirl.
Yeah. Like Popeye, you get them from pie.
Yes. I need my pie. Hey, an actual Popeye villain would be great.
Popeye.
That's Pot Pie. His name is Pot Pie, and he eats pie.
Pot Pie the Sailor.
Pot Pie the Trafficker Man.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Anyway, we are eating the Howard Dark, and that sentence just hurt my soul.
Yes. All right. Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed our conversations on these films.
Yes. But yeah, we'll be back next time with Battle Stars, and until then, we should cue some music. Woo! Music.
Skin.